Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Folks, this is a call-in show today, and our topic is the ABCs of inflation and hyperinflation. So please call in with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. Let me repeat that for you. That's 1-800-313-9443. Folks, today we have what I consider a very important foundational knowledge show. First, we have our special commentator, Miss Zoe Russell, with us today. Hello, Zoe.
Hi.
So, and also today, we are fortunate to have Dr. Jeffrey Herbner with us. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Michael.
Good. Dr. Herbner is a professor and chairman of the economics department at Grove City College, one of the premier schools teaching Austrian economics, which we refer to here at Radio Free Market as reality economics, because reality is not optional. As I announced, we're going to discuss the ABCs of inflation and hyperinflation. Now, Jeff, everybody thinks they know what inflation is. It's simply higher prices in most people's minds. But the story is not that simple. So let's start by asking you to explain the difference between price inflation and money inflation.
Right. That's a key distinction, of course, because monetary inflation is the cause of price inflation. Monetary inflation, of course, is when the government or money producer, whoever it might be, increases the money supply beyond what money demand is. And, of course, the result of this is that people hold excess money balances and then dispose of them by buying goods more readily and driving prices up.
So inflation, price inflation is what we see. And money inflation is what we do not see.
Yeah, that's right. Typically, just as people participating in the market, we don't see the monetary inflation figures. It's invisible to us. Of course, in this day and age, we can watch the statistics and actually see the money inflation side of it as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Zoe, you mentioned to me when we were prepping for the show that you have a favorite definition of inflation.
Yes, I do. I think that it's important to see what is a real good and what is just the paper. So I would say that more paper chasing fewer real goods and eventually bidding up their prices is my most clear definition of inflation.
Okay. Yeah, I like to think of it as pouring water into milk. You know, every new dollar that gets created by the central bank, by the federal government, through the central bank, is it actually diluting the value of each existing unit of money that we currently have? And I think that people, when they hear this word inflation, they should think my money in my pocket is going to buy less and be worth less. Do you agree with that, Jeff?
That's exactly right. The price inflation side of this whole story is just the devaluing, the lowering of the exchange value of money. That's exactly right. It's diluting the value of money.
So let's, I would like us to give us a background to the listeners as to some of the history of inflation, which is really, in one sense, the history of counterfeiting money. So I'd like to start with going back when before paper money, devaluing the currency, had to do with clipping coins. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. Well, back when all economies were on commodity money, that was the only way the money producer, the state in particular, could inflate the money supply.
I'm going to have to interrupt you, Jeff. I'm sorry. We're going to have to take a short break. It's going to move pretty quickly today, I can tell. So stay with us, folks. We'll be back right after the break. This is Radio Free Market. We're talking about the ABCs of inflation and hyperinflation. And we have Dr. Jeffrey Herbner with us. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and I have with me our special commentator, Zoe Russell, and along with us, our very special guest, Dr. Jeffrey Herbner. And Jeff, you were just talking about some of the history of inflating currency, and you were starting to talk about coin clipping. Could you recap that for us?
Sure. So back in the commodity money days, coin clipping would be the, I guess, most primitive way to engage in monetary inflation. The state would just clip away some of the coin and then take the metal and refashion new coins and then spend those as full face value coins and get the income redistribution of this process.
Mm-hmm. But the people were kind of hep to that. The coins were looking a little bit funny and jagged edge.
Right.
What did they do with that?
That's right. So that's where we get the innovation in minting, where ridges were put on the edges of coins so that you could tell if they'd been clipped off the edge.
And those ridges are called reading, I believe.
Yeah, readings, that's right. Yeah. And then the next thing, of course, the state would do is just debase the coins, just take the precious metal out of the coin, replace it with a base metal. And again, do the same thing, take the precious metal taken out of the coin and mint some new coins at full face value and then spend those. This, too, had problems. This could be detected by coloring and by sound. And so astute traders would be able to detect these counterfeited coins.
Is that where the term sound money comes from?
Yeah, sound money. And it was the innovation of economic theory in the Middle Ages by a guy named Nicholas Aresma, who was commentating on these ancient states that were the Romans and so on that were debasing and clipping coins, saying that what the economic effects of all this were. So economic theory was really born in an analysis of this kind of activity by the state.
So money actually is a good, just like any other, that is subject to the laws of supply and demand.
That's correct. So just like any other traded good, the price of any good will be based upon the conditions of the supply and demand. So if you increase the supply of any good, its price will fall. Also, this will be important for our discussions later about hyperinflation. If you decrease the demand for a good, its price will fall. So we know that there are two general, universal causal factors behind the price of something going down. Same thing with money, then. If the state is increasing the supply of money, other things the same, this would push the purchasing power of money down. And if we, as holders of money, decide to hold less of it, to spend it more readily, then our reduced demand would also push the purchasing power of money down.
In the history of money, there was a period, I believe, many hundreds of years ago, when there was a mint in what is now somewhere in the Balkans that was producing a very good quality silver unit called the thaler. And I believe I came across that this is actually the root of our term dollar. Is that correct?
That is correct. It was a silver coin, and this name was adopted into the nomenclature of our country. And actually, our dollar came from the Spanish milled dollar. And so this had a transition semantically through the Spanish money. It was produced in the New World in a mint in Mexico City that the colonists used.
When did paper money get started?
Well, paper money was first used in China and came into the West in Massachusetts, actually, in 1690. And here is where we had in the West the very first instance of hyperinflation, because the Massachusetts government used printing of paper money, of fiat, actually, paper money or credit money, as we call it, to pay for soldiers' wages that had made plunder raids into Canada. And the raids were unsuccessful, and the soldiers were in revolt, and so they paid them with paper money. And since the soldiers took the money, they thought, hey, this looks pretty good to us. Let's just keep printing paper money. And we had hyperinflation throughout the colonies in the early colonial history.
Mm-hmm. So you use the term fiat money, and I think you referred to it as credit money. I remember one of the other professors at Mises University, George Guido Holzman, refers to that as forced money.
Mm.
And So could you discuss a little bit more fiat money? This word fiat, it means declared, does it not?
I mean, that's correct. And so it has the connotation that the state simply declares something to be money and makes it so. But actually the economics behind it is a little bit more complicated than that. What typically happens is the state produces a money substitute, a paper money, let's say, that's redeemable into gold and silver, like the old treasury gold and silver certificate dollars. And then they overinflate the money, and redemption claims come in, and they take the step of breaking redemption. And when they break redemption, as long as people are willing to continue to use the paper money, it becomes fiat, irredeemable, in other words, into a commodity.
So fiat money basically is money that is money because the government says so.
That's correct. Government keeps it in circulation through legal tender laws and, as you said before, other means of force.
So, now Zoe, in our conversations, you made this this comment that we've had inflation many times in our country before 1913. Could you expand on that? Why did you pick 1913?
Well, that would be the beginning of the Federal Reserve. When I argue against the Federal Reserve, people don't know the history in this country before the Federal Reserve was there, but they do know there were other bouts with inflation. So I'd like to know about the other central bank experiments that we've had in this country.
Okay. Jeff, could you talk about that a little bit, some of the other inflationary periods that occurred in America before the Federal Reserve in 1913 was formed?
Sure. Well, we spoke already about the colonial governments, and so we had these hyperinflations in the early 1700s, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and the various colonies. And then the one that most students of American history know about is the continental issue of the Continental Congress and the Revolutionary War, which again just goes to show you that you don't have to have a central bank to have inflation or even a hyperinflation. This can just be done by the money production powers of the state. The Confederate States of America had a hyperinflation in the Civil War. You can see the pattern here, right? Wartime expenditures put strains on the budget, taxes are inadequate, and the state resorts to simply printing money.
I heard that somebody I was talking to recently made some comment about the Continental was actually, the hyperinflation on that was caused actually by the British who caused it to be overprinted. Is that true?
No, I don't. I've never read that. I mean, perhaps that's the case, but the standard story is, I think, sufficient to explain it. That there's pretty good empirical work that's been done on this about the monetary issue, the extent of it, and the extent of prices and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as again we'll talk about later, there is a demand side of this as well, and so it might have been if the British were trying to manipulate things on the demand side, let's say by having foreigners disgorge holdings if they had any, or starting rumors about the purchasing power, things like this.
Well, in the history of money, there have been many bouts of hyperinflation. There was John Law back in France in 17-teens, I think it was 1719 or so. There was the tulip bubble in Holland, other periods in the French late 1700s, there was a hyperinflation that occurred because of their printing of money at that time too.
Right,
and so, but basically, when government gets its hands on money, it's very hard, or I should say, on the ability to control the money supply. It becomes increasingly difficult for us to expect any kind of non-politicization of the money. In other words, it's often said that dictators fear revolutions, but in democracies they fear elections. And so in democracies they promise more and more, and they, if they need to, they pass the cost forward by printing additional money.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's there's never end to the short-run financial gain from printing more fiat paper money. And so inevitably the states take advantage of this. It's a Ludwig von Mises like to call this the an undemocratic policy. Mm-hmm. When they can't raise taxes on the citizens, they just resort to monetary inflation. That's a way to get around it.
Have paper monies ever worked anywhere?
Paper monies work as long as they're money substitutes, redemption claims mm-hmm. for a commodity money. So we could have the classic gold standard, let's say, and which could last, you know, for a longer time and be less inflationary than certainly than fiat paper monies. But the other aspect of this, of course, is fractional reserve banking.
Mm-hmm.
So that has to be factored in as well, because even under the classic gold standard, it was possible to increase money issue, to increase banknotes, since only a fraction of reserve of commodity money had to be held against the note issue. Mm-hmm. And so there we still can get inflation and eventually the collapse of the system.
Well, I'd like to bring out this fractional reserve banking concept in just a minute, but before we do, I'd like to ask a follow-up question on the idea of paper monies ever working. Has there been any empirical studies that you're aware of evaluating about how long fiat monies have or paper monies have worked?
I think the recognized literature on this says about 30 to 40 years. Fiat paper money's average life is about 30 to 40 years.
All right, so we're going to come back to that point when we get back, folks. This is Radio Free Market. We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Herbner on the ABCs of inflation and hyperinflation. This is very fascinating and very important for us to know. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. And I have with me today Dr. Jeffrey Herbner of Grove City College. And we're talking about the ABCs of inflation and hyperinflation. And so, Zoe, in the break, you and I were talking. Go ahead and bring out the point we were just talking about.
Well, if Nixon took us completely off the gold standard in 71, 38 years ago, do you see us pushing that 40-year mark very far with our fiat currency?
Well, it's hard to predict, certainly in the long run, the fiat paper money system in the U.S. is doomed. What's kept us going beyond the average, or at least near the average, so far, is simply that the under Bretton Woods, the dollar was the world reserve currency. In fact, it's still roughly 60% of all currency. Federal Reserve paper money currency is held outside the United States.
What kind of benefit does that give the dollar to be the world reserve currency?
Well, it keeps the demand for the dollar very high, and so the Fed is able to inflate the supply, and it's soaked up by this international demand without creating devaluation in the dollar itself.
But as every group of countries start to use other currencies to settle their trade, that reduces the amount of dollars that they need to hold. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, and we've seen this in international exchange markets lately. The rumblings of China last year, the Middle Eastern countries, and so on, have been talking for a long time about going to the euro and now about establishing their own regional currency.
Mm-hmm.
So
actually, it was just announced this past week, the Golfo. The yeah. Golfo is a currency that was actually announced that they're starting in the among the Arab states that will be mm-hmm. really based in Riyadh. And, of course, it's known right now that Brazil and China is settling its trade with the Chinese currency,
right.
And so the beginning of the end of the hegemony of the U.S. dollar is clearly here.
It appears so.
Yeah,
so I would agree with that.
This was just a delicate sort of agreement that they had. This wasn't set in stone by anybody. They all just had to settle their trade in dollars.
Well, actually, I know a little bit about this particular point, Zoe. It varies from area to area. I know that OPEC, it has been settling in dollars for since the 1940s, and for oil, and of course, decided in the late 90s to jump from that particular ship. He started settling in euros, which, of course, you know, well, we can see what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been a trade agreement that has been created around. And, Jeff, I'd love for you to speak more on that particular point.
Well, I think it it was part of the spoils of war after the victory in World War II, that the United States could dictate this sort of a system and then extend it, of course, to emerging areas of the world in terms of their economies, the Middle East, and then, of course, in Asia in the 1990s, and South America in the 1980s. So they've all been brought into the hegemony of the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in different ways, have dropped out or at least given rumblings about dropping out of the system.
Okay. You know, I like to talk about this aspect of inflation as being a tax. It's commonly not on most average people's radar that what we really live under is a system of planned inflation, where the Federal Reserve has a plan to constantly inflate the dollar and constantly debase the value of it. Since 1913, the purchasing power of the dollar has fallen between 96% and 98%. And, you know, there's a wonderful book that I always recommend, and people will find it recommended on my website, radiofreemarket.com, and it is Whatever Happened to Penny Candy is the name of the book. And it isn't Penny Candy went away, is that the dollar basically fell in value, and that's what caused Penny Candy to go away. So, you know, Zoe, you make the point that without this kind of tax, or without a overt taxing that we see, like income tax and so on, this is a way to constantly grow government in size and in scope. But most people aren't even aware of that. Are you finding that this is a shock to your students, Jeff, when you bring this point out to them?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they come in to my classes understanding almost nothing about money, not even, let's say, a simple thing like the nature of fractional reserve banking. But, the whole system of fiat money production is a system of income redistribution. And so the government is able to print the money, spend it first in line before prices have been bid up by the greater supply of money, and then so on, right? The first recipients then also get some advantage. It's one of the reasons why the new money is channeled through a banking system,
mm-hmm.
giving the bankers an advantage. And then it goes into the hands of producers of goods that are buying things on credit that the banks have extended, and they get some advantage. So the housing construction companies during the boom get some advantage.
Well, we're going to talk more about this and how inflation hides the winners and the losers after we get back after this break. This is Radio Free Market. We're talking about the ABCs of inflation and hyperinflation. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we're talking about the ABCs of inflation and hyperinflation. So, yeah, I'm handing the microphone back over to you.
Okay. What is fractional reserve banking, and how is it connected and protected to the Federal Reserve?
Well, that's a good question. It's another area my students are naive about when they first hear about fractional reserve banking, because they have a general impression that banking is run on the same rules of commerce as other businesses. And so they think, well, you know, if they have demand deposits and checking accounts, and the bank says you can come in and redeem these checking account balances anytime for cash, and the bank actually keeps the cash in the vault. But, of course, they don't. Now, this, too, is another area where the state has forced its own will onto the market economy. This is not something that would occur in the unhampered market economy. So a fractional reserve bank is a bank that holds only a fraction of money reserve against its money substitutes, typically checking account balances. And, of course, this creates illiquidity, as we say in economics. It means that the bank can't meet its redemption claims under all conditions, that we can have bank runs. and banks can be bankrupted simply by customers redeeming, you know, the bank fulfilling their obligation to customers for redemption of their checking accounts into cash.
Mm-hmm. And so in fractional reserve banking, basically, the banks are creating money out of thin air.
That's correct. And they do this by extending loans.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a reserve, let's say, of $1 million, a cash reserve, and if they're holding a 10% reserve ratio of their money substitutes, they can create $10 million in checking account balances.
So
and
about 10 to 1.
They do this just by issuing loans.
Mm-hmm. Is there a ratio that we could that the listener could basically think about in terms of whenever they put a dollar in the bank, they could think, oh, my bank is now going to be able to create out of thin air maybe 10 more dollars?
That's correct. The official ratio is about 10% reserve.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual practice of banks is maybe between, it's certainly under 5%, maybe between 2 and 3% in normal times, and not currently, but mm-hmm. they hold only about 2 or 3% reserve.
So they can create as much as 50 times the money.
Yeah.
So, in other words, in terms of the creation of money, artificial money, fractional reserve banking is really where it's at. This is the primary way that inflation, that monetary inflation, is really created in our economy.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And just like with the production of more fiat paper money, the issuance of, you know, more money substitutes by extending loans is indefinitely profitable for the banks. They cannot regulate this by the normal rules of commerce, which is let's produce something as long as it's profitable, because it's always profitable to extend another loan and run your reserve down just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to this concept that we were talking about a few minutes ago about who benefits and who is punished by this concept of inflation. Obviously, if you're pouring water into milk, if you're basically diluting the value of money by this constant inflating of the money supply, people who are saving money, they're definitely being punished.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
But this would reward people who borrow money, because they're going to be repaying money, repaying loans back with money that's worth less.
Yeah, cheaper dollars, that's right.
So,
now, of course,
doesn't that incentivize everyone to just constantly be in debt?
And that factor is also reinforced by the credit expansion that sets in motion the monetary inflation to begin with. Because cheap credit is available, interest rates are low, and so the whole economy becomes indebted just through the normal process of Fed-created monetary inflation.
So consumers are the last to actually see prices going up, and they're the ones that are really left holding the bag, while the people who get the use of the money first get the full value of this new, or nearly the full value of this newly created money.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so most people have income, most just regular middle-class people have income redistributed away from them because they're paying higher prices for things. The income is redistributed towards the state and those who receive the inflated money early in this process.
Mm-hmm. So the people that are going to be hurt the worst are savings, people who have savings or trying to live off of their savings, like the elderly, mm-hmm. for example, those who get the money last, basically.
That's exactly correct.
Okay, so let's talk for a second about this opposite concept, because we constantly read in the press about how the Fed is deathly afraid of deflation. Now, deflation, of course, if we're going to be proper about this, there's monetary deflation and there's price deflation. But let's talk about price deflation for just a minute. What's so bad about prices going down? I mean, don't we all want our dollars to go farther for our purchasing power to be improved?
That's correct. There isn't anything, generally speaking, bad about price deflation. If you just look at American history, you can see that the times in American history of greatest economic progress, say the second half of the 19th century, were periods of mild price deflation. So there isn't anything disabling or harmful about price deflation generally to economic activity.
We have a caller, Patrick, from Pennsylvania, that has actually been waiting for quite some time. Still on the phone?
I'm still here.
Well, welcome to the show, Pat.
Well, thank you, Michael. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello, Patrick.
Enjoy your show, and I don't know what it's doing over there in Pittsburgh, but here in Philadelphia, Jeffrey, we've got a foot of snow, which is very unusual for us.
we only have half that.
So. Oh, well, we don't know how to handle it here. I think you do. I've just got a couple comments. Maybe, Jeffrey, you could talk a little bit about these, but I've read a little bit about post-World War II, immediate post-World War II Germany, where the United States had had distributed its military script widely, and that this military script was just destroying what was retarding the recovery of the German economy, and that there was a thought that the Russians were actually counterfeiting the money themselves, that they had gotten the plates or had been able to replicate this military script. And it was Ludwig Erhard's action. I think, from what I understand anecdotally, there was some kind of holiday, and during the holiday when the Americans were gone, he abolished the military script and instituted the Deutschmark. And you can, maybe you can, if you know anything about that. And then my other comment would be, it seems to me, and you can just tell me what you think of this, Jeffrey, that the stock market, which has been hovering, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has been hovering in the 10,000 point range for, you know, the past year or so. If the Fed allowed interest rates, if they stopped manipulating the interest rates, I would think that the stock market would go down to who knows what level. Because when interest rates are zero in your bank deposit, it encourages people to try to get something for their money, so they try to find some safe stocks to get into. And one of the reasons that the Fed is keeping the interest rates low is not only do they have the false idea that they want banks to continue lending, but they want to keep rewarding their buddies on Wall Street and keep the stock market up and people's 401k plans intact. So they're just trying to paper over all of it with 0% money. And I just wonder if you could, if you just wanted to speak to those issues.
Yeah, sure.
Well, thank you, Pat.
Yeah, you're right about Ludwig Erhard, of course. The script problem was only one part of a large apparatus of Allied controls on the German economy, and Erhard did away with all of them. He just completely ridded the German economy of wage and price controls, this artificial money, all sorts of other restrictions, and of course we had the German economic miracle, as we call it, the rebounding of the German economy after World War II. So it was a great success for free markets. On the stock question, this is very typical behavior by the Fed. You see this now, so we get a stock market crash, and then they attempt to reinflate the stock market. They did this in 1929. It's very typical for them to try to, as you say, you know, reinflate these asset prices so that their friends on Wall Street have fewer losses than they otherwise would. So their policy of holding interest rates down, the monetary inflation, the huge monetary inflation that they've built up in the system lately, is responsible for lifting stocks back up to this level. And if they remove this policy, you're absolutely right, the stock market would sag.
Okay. Well, Pat, thank you very much for your input. We appreciate that. We also have George in Texas. George? Hello, George.
I've been sort of like looking at his... you know, this phony, funny money, and I always try to tell the Christian leaders, the church people, and all that stuff, that this flawed, immoral monetary system is the direct route to our moral decline in society, because if there was honest money, there would not be a moral decline. But since we got this funny money, it's attributed to our moral failures.
Well, that's I would definitely agree that that at the essence of all economic issues, we really are discussing moral issues, and because we're talking about the property rights of people and the reliability of contracts, the reliability of our word, the intelligence of our laws. And so that's a very good insight, George. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Well, like I said, the love of money is the root of all evil.
So, very good. So, let's go back for a minute there and talk for a second more, Jeffrey, if you would, on the concept of fractional reserve banking. I've seen it said that fractional reserve banking, the concept of having more money out, the bank lending more money out than it actually has on deposit, is like selling the same horse to several different people because they want to ride it on different days of the week. But this idea will work until the several owners all meet and decide to have a horse race. You know, because obviously, in its very essence, this is really fraud.
It's absolutely right. It's the to put it back to the money itself, it's the issuance by the bank of competing legal claims to the same piece of property, which again is just the I would say the definition of fraud. It's as if I would issue another title of ownership to my car and then sell it to someone and still retain the legal ownership claim that I have. You can't have two competing legitimate ownership claims, but that's exactly what fractional reserve banking is.
So I'm going to jump back a little bit here. Let's talk about deflation again, because obviously deflation, prices going down, it means our purchasing power is actually improved. But we see actually certain industries where there's been a consistency of deflation. So, for example, electronics, TVs, computers, but also in some medical procedures, LASIK surgery, plastic surgery, where quality and features have actually, and actually benefits have gone up, and prices have gone down at the same time. So why is it, do you think, that we have certain segments of our economy where we do see these deflationary pressures and other segments where we see inflationary pressures?
Well, I think the deflation that you see in these particular areas of the economy come precisely from improvements in the technology and production conditions. And so it's possible to lower costs.
Would you also agree, though, that prices, some of these are because they're more free market? In other words,
sure,
they're less controlled by any kind of government intervention?
Sure, but remember, overlapped on that, of course, is the general trend of what's happening to the purchasing power of money.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, that industry, like the computer industry, is actually bucking that trend entirely. And as you say, it's partly the entrepreneurial efficiency of the more market-oriented nature of that industry, plus technological improvement, other productivity factors mm-hmm. that tend to increase supply and or lower average costs and permit the extension of this process. And this, again, is what you see in any instance of economic progress in the market, in the auto industry, in the Henry Ford days, and so on. It's just, it's exactly the same thing. You see entrepreneurial insight and operation management, you know, efficient management, and it's coupled with improvements in efficiency, cost lowering.
And less government intervention at the same time.
Yeah, and what makes room for the prices to fall. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you my other question I was leading up to earlier a little bit differently. Why are we being taught in the press and by comments by Geithner and so on and so forth that deflation is bad, when it is inflation that is really bad for our long-term economic calculation?
Well, they, of course, have their own interest in maintaining, as we mentioned before, asset prices. From Patrick's call, they're financially connected to interests who have gone through the boom bust and benefited from the very high asset prices in the boom, and then lost all of that capital when the market crashed. And they're interested in reinflating these asset prices to restore the lost wealth to that particular elite group.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a very interesting point. On my website, radiofreemarket.com, I have referred people in one of the essays that we have available for free download to Guido Holzman's short book called Deflation and Liberty. Mm-hmm. And in that book, he brings out this very important point that inflation hides the winners and the losers, but deflation reveals the winners and the losers. And so,
yeah, exactly right.
Okay. And so, this is something that I think is very important for the public to understand that deflation reveals the winners and the losers. Who are the winners? They're the consumers. And who are the losers? The losers are basically those that overextend themselves in credit. And but we're going to talk about that more in a little bit. We are coming to another break, folks, and so please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we'll be back with Dr. Jeffrey Herbner in just a minute as we conclude our comments about the ABCs of inflation and hyperinflation. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we're into our last segment. We have Dr. Jeffrey Herbner. We're talking about the ABCs of inflation and hyperinflation. So, Jeffrey, you made a point at the beginning of the show that money is a good, like any other good. But interest rates are also a price, like any other price. They're a price for the good. So could you discuss that for just a second?
Oh, sure. The interest rates, as you say, are just the price that people place upon their preference that they have for present goods over future goods. It's an intertemporal price. So we lend and borrow based on this price. Some people have more urgent needs for present money, and others are more willing to lend, and so trade comes into existence, and then just like in any market, the interest rate adjusts to clear the market.
And clearing the market means what?
It means that the amount of lending and borrowing are the same, that the lenders wish to lend to the borrowers just the amount of money that the borrowers wish to borrow from the lenders.
Okay. So let's talk about hyperinflation because when the Fed created these additional trillions of dollars a year ago to bail out the banks and prop up the banking industry, a lot of people, myself included, saw this akin to that earthquake at sea that happened in the Indian Ocean some time ago that was going to have an immediate effect on some of the shoreline of prices going down, a deflationary effect. But then, just like that analogy, there would be a period of very high inflation afterward, and as that money makes its way into the general population. So what are some of the danger signs that people can look for this hyperinflation that I personally believe is still out there available to happen, and which I like to call planned and uncontrollable inflation? What would you say are some of the danger signs related to this that we should be looking for?
All right. Well, one thing we need to watch out for from this point on is how the Fed manages these bank reserves. What's happening to these bank reserves? Are they diminishing or staying the same or continuing to build up?
Mm-hmm.
So that would be one thing to watch. Also, the interest, the Fed pays interest on these bank reserves now, so that would be another sign to watch. Are they having to raise the interest rate to restrain banks from lending this money, to give them incentive to hold the money? Mm-hmm. So that would be another thing to watch early
in
the process.
So the Fed actually, based on what it does, could actually incentivize these banks to get that money out into circulation.
That's correct. And they're trying to
do that
now.
So we want that not to happen.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. And then once the process begins, of course, which it may have already done, we would watch for currency devaluations. We would see what's happening to the dollar relative to foreign currencies, and also what's happening to the repatriation of the dollars that are being held overseas. This, too, is slipping some. I mentioned the percentage is between 50 and 60% now, but in the early 1990s, it was higher. It was maybe two-thirds or even 70%. So we'd watch for that. Of course, then when the inflation picks up, there's a tendency for states to try to hide the effects of it with wage and price controls or, let's say, controls on capital flows and so on. So obviously those would be things to watch for later in the process.
That's a fascinating topic. Folks, please go to our website, radiofreemarket.com, and pick up some of our essays on monetary ignorance equals you are at risk in our education area. And thank you today, Dr. Jeffrey Herbner and Zoe Russell, our special commentator, for a fascinating show. And stay with us, folks. Next week, we'll be talking again with Dr. Thomas Woods on Meltdown, his best-selling book. Thank you very much for being with us. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay. Thank you very much for your time.